realities and your weather to us that live outside of your community. We've had a great day today touring around out to Chena Hot Springs and to the university and the Center for Energy and Power and the Cold Climate Research Housing Center. So thank you. We're delighted to be here today. I'm Senator Lisa McGuire, and I co-chair the Resources Committee and chair the Energy Committee in the Senate. And I'll just go around here and let everybody introduce themselves.
Bill Wilikowski, co-chair of the Senate Resources Committee.
Hi, I'm Hollis French, and I represent West Anchorage, Turnigan, and Spinard in the State Senate.
Tom Wagoner, I'm from Kenai. I represent everything from the Nilchek North.
Gary Stevens, Senate President. I represent primarily Kodiak, Homer, and Seward.
And Joe Thomas, Senate District D, which the university is in, and a good chunk of the rest of
warm during long Alaskan winters need a short-term solution that meets their unique needs. Senate Bill 162 is a short-term solution that, in addition to the many other solutions and promising long-term matters that you currently are considering and implementing, and you've today out at Chena Hot Springs had the opportunity to look at some of those and at the Cold Climate Housing Research. But Senate Bill 162 is a short-term solution to a very serious and important problem in interior Alaska. And Senate Bill 162 puts a solution in place in case the price of heating oil rises again as rapidly as it declined. And in interior Alaska, when the price of a barrel of crude was $140 a barrel and we were paying over $4 a gallon, it was a problem that was crushing too many residents in interior Alaska. In the past year, Alaskans' discretionary income has evaporated, consumer debt has risen sharply, and the cost of heating oil is still beyond the ability of many Alaskans to pay. A sharp rise in heating oil now, while beneficial to the state budget, would economically devastate individual Alaskans, business owners, and their families. Senate Bill 162 will require the state of Alaska to provide energy relief to home and commercial heating costs when the price of a barrel of crude rises to the point where the state of Alaska is enjoying budget surpluses. If and only if the price of heating oil triggers the measures outlined in Senate Bill 162, is it reasonable to ask the people of the state of Alaska to pay $2.50 a gallon while the state would pay the balance from its surplus directly to the home heating oil dealers, the distributors? With that temporary solution in place, Alaskans can focus their attention on the long-term solutions that will restore optimism about our economic future, protect our families and businesses, and allow us to concentrate on our number one priority, which are renewable and sustainable energy solutions for the state of Alaska. Senate Bill 162 is easily administered. The distributors of home heating oil, as part of their current reporting requirements, send the state of Alaska a monthly breakdown of all the quantities of the various petroleum products they sell, which does include the home heating oil. The quantities of home heating oil are easily verifiable and objectively determinable. It is efficient and in that it does not create a bureaucracy of paperwork or require massive government employment to operate effectively. Rather than distributing checks or debit cards to tens of thousands of individuals, the state would make the payment directly to the heating oil distributors. It is a relatively simple way to utilize the surplus that would be in the state's bank account when the state is enjoying a budget surplus due to the high cost of crude to reduce the cost of heating oil to the Alaskans who need it most. In other words, we would put the state surpluses directly into the heating tanks of the homeowners and businesses. Senate Bill 162 requires the consumer price of heating oil to increase each of the next 3 years, reinforcing the need for Alaskans to conserve and to plan for the long-term solution. So I hopefully would urge the Senate Resources Committee to support this legislation, and in the interest of brevity, we'll stop talking.
Thank you very much. Questions for Senator Pascavan at this time? Okay, we'll bring it up later. So now we'll go ahead and invite members from the public here to testify. And just if I could ask you to keep it to 5 minutes so that everyone has a chance to testify. We're here as part of an interim process of developing a comprehensive energy policy and plan of execution to go forward with in January. The executive branch is looking at that as well. House and the Senate are also looking at it, and so we want to hear your viewpoints here in Fairbanks. So we'll start with Jesse Peterson.
Wonderful people ready and willing to take the helm, and so SB 150 is a great way to get things rolling here. Also, SB 121, Energy Efficiency for Public Buildings. Great way to show that the state is willing to step up and lead the way. And also, though, on a really more practical level, that energy efficiency investments have a quick payback period, and the money saved can help balance the higher capital costs that sometimes are associated with renewable energy projects. So it's time for Alaskans to reclaim our position as leaders. We're blessed with abundance, diversity of renewable energy options and innovative leaders to make it happen. An investment in renewable energy and energy efficiency measures will simultaneously create new economic opportunities while helping to also address the issue of our time, which is climate change. Thank you for dedicating your week to exploring and learning more about the vast and innovative energy potential across Alaska, and most importantly, for listening to what Alaskans want in an energy policy. It's certainly time to be bold, so go forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Jesse. I appreciate your comments. And I know several states have gone into the RPS renewable standards. Could you explain that very briefly, what that is and how it actually works? Is it establish a percentage that you have to achieve by specific times? Is that the goal of the RPS?
Yep, it sure is. What I really like about it, the RPS, and I learned a lot more about it at the Renewable Energy Conference a week or so ago, is that basically it is an obligation. It's kind of a hard word, but it is an obligation on electricity supply companies to produce a specific fraction of their electricity from renewable energy sources. The great thing, though, is that it's very flexible. Every state has taken it and molded it in a different way to make it fit for their state based on their resources and based on their energy portfolio. So, again, basically what it's doing is that it's also, though, encouraging utilities. The state does help to cover some of the costs of this. If you would like more information than I'm able to give you, read the Renewable Energy Alaska Project and their executive director, Chris Rose. They have an abundance of information on their website for in person, and they really help me understand the flexibility of it, which I think is what Alaska needs.
Thank you, Jesse.
Thank you very much, Jesse. Okay, next we have David Gardner.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman. I'm Dave Gardner with Golden Valley Electric Association. I want to thank you very much for being here today. Golden Valley is very pleased to have this opportunity to discuss Alaska's energy future. Energy, as has often been said, is the lifeblood of our society. Energy is also, at least in many of its current forms, a scarce resource. As demand for energy increases in Alaska and around the world, as current stocks of oil and natural gas are depleted, and as new regulatory structures establish financial disincentives for carbon-emitting fossil fuels, the cost of these fuels may rise sharply. As Alaskans, we accept the necessity of belt tightening in difficult times. However, the problem of ensuring continual access to affordable, reliable energy is a problem. The problem that will call upon the creativity and dedication of the private sector and upon the rigors and actions of local, state, and federal governments. Golden Valley strongly advocates the development of a comprehensive energy plan for Alaska. The energy plan will be a vision of the role that Alaskan utilities and state government officials, agencies, and elected representatives can play in solving the energy problem and shaping our energy future. To be sure, the United States government must address larger issues such as funding for energy research and development and legislation for regulation of greenhouse gases. However, these are steps that Alaskans can take to move toward a more stable, independent pattern of energy generation and use. Here's what we feel should be the components of this plan and what the plan should attempt to identify. Number one, utility scale, renewable resources. Statutory requirements that stipulate Alaska's energy utilities provide power to consumers at the lowest possible cost has helped keep electric rates in the state low. However, certain features of this structure in Alaska have acted as barriers to the amount of electricity generated by renewable energy resources in the state, especially the utility scale projects. Alaska's lawmakers and electric utilities will need to work together to overcome these barriers of carbon emissions from traditional fossil fuel power plants come under greater scrutiny in the coming months and years. Number two, energy efficiency. Energy efficiency, or the reduction of the demand for electricity, is generally considered a resource. reducing consumption by 1 kilowatt hour is equivalent to increasing supply by that same amount. Thus, products and practices such as programmable thermostats, smart meters, efficient appliances and lighting systems, building insulation, and simple common sense reductions in demand can all play a role in meeting Alaska's energy production needs. Number three, transmission. Increasing the amount of electricity generated by renewable energy sources, replacing aging infrastructure, and development of a transmission grid across Alaska will require a significant investment in the construction of new transmission lines. Much like the job of power pooling organizations in the lower 48, we must establish an Alaska power pool to facilitate the planning and coordination of transmission line development throughout the state. The responsibilities of the Alaska Power Pool would include planning, siting, routing of transmission lines, in addition to the sources of financing for the new lines and for line upgrades. These are difficult and expensive tasks, but achievable if local, state, and federal officials work together with public and private utilities for mutually beneficial solutions. Number four, energy diversity. Regardless of the future regulatory changes, the focus of Alaska's electric utilities must be on developing a diverse portfolio of generating sources in order to provide affordable, reliable energy to Alaska in the most environmentally responsible manner. Because of Alaska's vast natural resources, a diversified energy portfolio must include coal, hydroelectric, oil, natural gas, wind, solar, geothermal, and biomass. Number five, as we previously mentioned, the Renewable Portfolio Standards, or Renewable Energy Standards. These are a statutory requirement that all utilities within a state generate a certain percentage of electricity they distribute from renewable resources. Currently, 28 states have adopted an RPS or an RES legislation, and changes within the federal government, including President Obama's renewable initiative and shifts in the congressional committees, indicate that nationwide RPS or RES may be enacted in the near future. However, Golden Valley opposes mandatory RPS and RES legislation because without careful consideration, these requirements can create inequities among the utilities from one region to another and cause electric consumers to suffer from low electric reliability and precipitously high rate increases. Number six, other resource utilization methods and actions include partnering with the Alaska Legislature and Interior Alaska's Congressional Delegation to extend the federal protection tax credits for renewable energy, to make federal tax credits for wind energy available, to increase the annual appropriations for the Renewable Energy Product Incentive, or RPI. REPI is designed to offer public utilities incentives for development of renewable generation capacity in place of production tax credits for which they don't qualify. Expansion of the Clean Renewable Energy Bonds, or CREBs. Under one congressional plan, billions in CREBs would be available to public utilities and electric cooperatives for renewable energy projects. Support continuation of federal tax credits for small-scale wind production. Support the continuation of federal tax credits for residential photovoltaic electric generation systems. And in partnership with the University of Alaska, support the development and rapid, low-cost implementation of carbon capture and sequestration techniques at existing and future coal-fired generating plants. Number seven, support for the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. Researching new energy technologies is crucial for the continuing availability of affordable, reliable energy in Alaska. Research that leads to advances in the viability or efficiency of renewable energy technologies, for example, can create jobs, lessen dependency on foreign oil, reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Research that identifies new means of conservation can help lower demand for energy and thereby lower the cost. Through cooperation with federal grant-making bodies, local and state governments, and national research institutions, the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, based right here at the University of Alaska, can play a leading role in tackling these research questions. And number eight, plan today for energy solutions for tomorrow. Golden Valley supports the efforts of the Senate and House Special Committees on Energy to develop a vision for Alaska's energy future.
A vision would be instrumental in establishing both the energy policies and plans that streamline current energy programs as well as develop future energy solutions for the state. In closing, Golden Valley Electric Association suggests the following draft as Alaska's energy policy. It is the policy of the state of Alaska, through a statewide energy plan, to have adequate, reliable, affordable, sustainable, and clean energy resources by promoting the development of non-renewable energy resources, including natural gas, coal, and oil, and renewable energy resources, including geothermal, solar, wind, biomass, and hydroelectric. Alaska will promote the development of resources and infrastructure sufficient to meet the state's growing energy demand while reducing dependency on foreign energy sources through energy conservation, through energy efficiency, energy research, energy-related workforce development, and state regulatory processes that balance economic costs with environmental quality.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Can we have a copy?
I have it. Ready for you, right?
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. Really appreciate that testimony. A quick question for you. Actually, two questions. Number one is on RPS. You said renewable portfolio standards. You do not support mandatory RPS?
We do not support mandatory RPS.
But you support voluntary RPS?
Correct.
Are there states that have voluntary RPS?
I am not sure. There are 28 states who have enacted them, and I don't know the method by which they enact.
And then the other question was on your first point. I didn't quite get it. Could you just quickly tell me what that was again?
Utility-scale renewable resources, large-scale wind farms, large-scale projects, rather than individual projects that are being developed here in the interior of this time.
Great. Thank you.
Further questions? Senator Stevens.
Just, David, ask you if you could comment a little just briefly on the issue of coal. I understand what you're saying is that we have to have coal and oil to generate electricity that has to be used, and we can't, we don't want to put ourselves in a position of foreign, buying everything from foreign countries. But is, and I ask you this as someone who has no knowledge about clean coal production, is that a reality? Is that a possibility? Is that something you are, as a company, are looking into? Is such a thing as clean coal electric production possible? Is it something that you are working towards?
We are definitely working towards clean coal, cleaner coal burning all the time. The clean coal project that we're intimately involved in is one of the first steps in that process. We definitely don't consider it to be the last step by any means, but with any development of any new technology, you have to take it one step at a time. This project is one step on that.
And can you tell us any percentage of how that's cleaning up the amount of carbon production? Any numbers on that?
Well, to give you an example, this plant is located directly adjacent to the existing Unit 1 coal-fired power plant, which is a 25-megawatt power plant. The new plant is a 50-megawatt power plant, which means when the two plants are operated together, they will be producing three times power and producing less emissions than the existing plant was when it was first built, before the retrofits were enacted on the first plant and the second plant was started.
Thank you.
And Senator Jean Theriault has joined us. Jean, why don't you come on up? There's a seat here for you. Further questions? Anyone? Senator Tobin.
Thank you for your testimony. Just a couple of quick questions. What does Golden Valley look at as far as what renewables would be available? And I don't want to get too micro-geographic here, but Golden Valley's area, what do they look at as projects that would be feasible and reasonable in the renewable area?
Well, on the larger scale, wind is our primary here in the interior of the state. However, we believe that getting together with the other area utilities and a project like Susitna is in the best interest of the state.
And you look at Susitna based on the concept that we're going to run out of oil and gas at some point in time, and we'll all be looking back saying, boy, we should have built that dam.
We should have built that dam, yeah.
He took the words right out of your mouth.
Yeah, you did. Thank you.
Further questions? Okay, thank you very much for your thoughtful testimony. Appreciate it. Okay, next, William Sackinger.
Madam Chair, if I might.
Yes.
Anyone who has written testimony, if we could get copies of that,
yes,
would be greatly, I greatly appreciate that.
Absolutely.
For future.
Trevor, will you? Trevor's got it, and we'll distribute it to everyone who's
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you very much for coming here. retired from the University of Alaska in the field of geophysics and electrical engineering 14 years ago, and I think it's been about 60 years that I've been studying the energy business from the technical and economic viewpoints, and particularly in the last 14 years. You can see I don't have written remarks to give you, so but I'll tell you what I've been thinking about in the last 14 years in particular. First, let me take a global, then a national, then an Alaskan viewpoint. The global viewpoint is oil is going to level off in production in the year 2014, and there will be a demand for oil in the world that will exceed the supply. And this has been predicted by the International Energy Agency. My reading on this is that there will be about a $30 a barrel increment of oil prices due to that particular effect alone. You might add, what will we do? Well, one thing that will happen is that natural gas and coal will be brought to bear to produce hydrocarbon liquids that will be useful for transportation fuels. We can't expect to fly airplanes with electricity, and we are always going to need hydrocarbon liquid fuels. Now, the question comes in about the price of oil in the future. The price of oil escalates due to the natural escalation of the gross world product. 2 or 3% is a rough number. It also escalates according to the devaluation of the dollar against the other basket of currencies in the world, which has been running in the neighborhood of 4 to 5% per year. Now that we've decided to print an extra $1 trillion of dollars, I suspect this escalation rate will be even higher than 4 or 5% per year. If you take those numbers and just do the standard compound interest calculations, you come up with $150 a barrel of oil about 2014 or 2015. This means that the normal refining markup of $20 or so means it will be paying $170 a barrel at the pump, as it were. And that's kind of a low estimate. And it will continue to get higher after that. So what do we do about this? Well, certainly we want to produce as much oil as we can in Alaska. And so we want to be extremely careful to squeeze all the oil out of our reservoirs if we can. We want to, of course, discover new oil, but we can't expect elephant-sized fields. We have to deliver carbon in all three forms, oil, gas, and coal. So fortunately, Alaska has all of that, and it's time to move the Alaskan gas from its reservoir into the world market. Now, from a national standpoint, the nation, as well as the world, as well as Alaska, will all be facing the kind of problems I've just described. And so, naturally, the nation is trying to forestall the demand shortfall problem by changing the amount of gasoline used by the automobiles. Last week, we got a reading from the president about how that will help. Now, the Chinese are not reading those tea leaves. The Indians are not reading those tea leaves. They will be continuing to grow in their transportation needs and all their other industrial needs at about 8% in China and 6% in India. So what we're looking at is we should get our gas out so that the world can use it and so that the nation can use it and so that Alaska can use it. Actually, there's plenty of gas in the tight shale in the South 48, and it's unlikely that this long pipeline that we have talked about in Canada will come to about to pass, but we can expect a separate high-priced gas market in the Pacific Rim, which is fed by LNG from Qatar and Soviet Union and Iran and the various other gas suppliers of LNG. So I think that if our LNG can be brought online, we will find a high-priced market in the Pacific Rim for it somewhere on an energy equivalent basis to be equivalent to oil. Let me talk just a minute about coal gasification and clean coal, because I've been into that. Clean coal is a buzzword from 20 years ago, and I don't like to use it because I'd like to have a different and more modern definition of how coal can perform. Coal should perform so that there are no particulate emissions going into the air at all, no 2.5 and minus, no, nothing at all. And coal should perform so that the carbon dioxide that comes from the coal is fully utilized, either going into a sequestration or into an industrial process. The carbon from the coal that goes into a conversion, like into a hydrocarbon liquid, should be optimized. And the way we can do that in the proposed coal and gas conversion plant that we talked about in Fairbanks is to have about two-thirds natural gas feedstock and one-third coal feedstock. And if we do that, we'll have the optimum 2-to-1 ratio of hydrogen to carbon that the output has to have, and all of the carbon in that instance can appear as either useful hydrocarbon fuel or carbon dioxide. And then we have to deal with sequestration of carbon dioxide, and I think we should. I think we should sequester the carbon dioxide. Finally, there's a lot of waste heat in every plant in the world. Waste heat, you see it just escaping. It's time for waste heat to be used for district heating. Fairbanks needs district heating. It needs hot water. It needs 200 degree Fahrenheit water, and this kind of a plant will certainly produce that. That will really heat a lot of houses. I think I'd better stop, and thank you all for listening, and we want to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sechinger. Questions? Okay. Thank you. We appreciate your thoughts and your time. Okay, Rich Seifert. Welcome.
Thank you, Senator McGuire, and thank you all for coming here. It's really always like this. Don't worry if you're not being treated specially. I am the energy and housing specialist for Cooperative Extension at the university here. I've been surrounded as a part of the university for most of my professional life. I've never lived anywhere but Fairbanks, but I have a very keen interest and a very long history with energy policy, energy applied in our lives. I teach a course on solar energy design for Alaskans. I teach a course on cold climate home building for Alaskans as part of the extension work that I do. I'm going to try and leave you with some major tenets, because I understood this to be a policy discussion. And, I wish I had an hour with you, because believe me, professors always have more to say than they have time. But there are plenty of things you can say about the economy, past and future, with some confidence right now. First of all, and I want to say this, you've heard it, but you've heard a lot of hemming and hawing around it. Cheap energy is over. Let's get over that idea. And our wishes for alternative energy are currently inconsistent with reality, because we think we can do everything with alternative energy that we now do with fossil energy. It is not possible. Get over it. That does not mean, however, that renewable energy can't do the job of keeping us in a modern technical civilization. And I'm going to talk more about that shortly. I think this is the issue that I want to key on. I have a presentation that I'll give you here, but this is a world liquid fuel production graph, and it shows that very likely, in spite of what Dr. Sechinger said, 2014, I think we're already at peak oil. And it looks like it from these are a plot of both the International Energy Agency and the Energy Information Agency, which is a U.S. agency. We have peaked, very likely. The graphic makes it clear. And I want to stress something about that whole situation that I've come to understand is an important insight from my work, from my whole life here. It's come down to me through helping fellow Alaskans use whatever each homeowner can of the weatherization rebate money that, thank you, legislature, for providing. The most unlikely thing that's ever happened in my whole life was the legislature suddenly dumping $300 million on the table and saying, energy conservation, retrofit your houses. Not only is this the best first thing you should do, it's exactly the way I would start if I had done it myself. So whoever was behind that, that is brilliant, and it's, like I said, the most unlikely thing that I've ever seen happen from the legislature. But I wish it had happened 10 years ago in my life, but I'm getting older now. People always think they want lower energy costs.
well, my idea that cheap energy is over means that that's a pretty empty promise. For instance, that's what the governor says her goal is for the future, to lower energy costs and keep energy affordable. But not only is that unlikely, it's something we never have and never will control. And that's what people refuse to face. All of the major fossil fuel prices are set internationally. And it is in our best interest to sell our oil internationally and at the highest possible price. It is also in our best interest to not need it ourselves, to conserve. Folks need to appreciate is that energy conservation is what gives them the freedom to not need fuel, or at least to not need as much, regardless of what it costs. That is in their control, and the state is doing the right thing to make this more affordable to achieve with the money that you gave. It's the first best step towards sustaining our way of life in our communities, and when we do that, next will be food, health care, and transportation. And if we manage, we'll work together and see the path which best gets us there. I also want to talk about, I was in the community of Kodiak, Senator Stevens. I really was impressed by Kodiak, and Kodiak is exemplary in one way. I think a major thrust for state energy policy should be this. As soon as it's physically feasible, and I think we should look into using our permanent fund at least as a collateral to help finance these ideas. We should convert all electrical production facilities to renewable resources to the maximum degree possible. Why? Well, here are all the basics. Number one, all modern communication and financial transactions require the electrical grid to be functioning and efficient. Without it, we haven't got a technical civilization. It's primal. Two, renewable energy as a source of power for this electrical grid ensures that we can all maintain our communications, health, financial connections without threatening the climate. This will surely be a major factor in future planning and electrical production. We can't have electricity use causing our climate and food system to fail. Moving toward renewable energy is simply the best and safest way to ensure our future access to electricity, by far the most important energy source we need and must have to maintain our best standard of living. The reason I say Kodiak is exemplary in this is Kodiak's already 60% electrified with hydro, Terra Lake, and they're putting in 3 1.5-megawatt wind turbines this summer. They're going to come close to 90% renewable for electricity. This idea came to me at a lecture in Kodiak. I was asked if there was one thing I could say to a community about how to secure the energy future for them, what would it be? Well, I'd never been asked that question before, but luckily I had an answer for them, and I said, get all of your electricity renewably based, because renewable energy requires us to use local resources to the maximum extent and protect them accordingly. This will further enhance our local cooperation and strengthen communities and even improve our environmental quality. And finally, Steve Hoggenson is an appointee of the governor as the sort of AEA energy czar. And AEA energy policy work he's doing with his staff has really been quite good. I've just recently had a conversation with him and generally support his work. He's committed to moving Alaska to renewable energy as much as our energy is feasible in the future. And the future must begin now and fervently pursue this crucial goal of maximizing renewable energy electrification in Alaska. Now, I work in a cooperative extension service as an energy specialist, but my job is much more than that. I believe that an energy perspective and the vision which informs me, along with the tools and information available in the Cooperative Extension Service and from my peers, has led me to endorse fully moving toward a sustainable Alaska by what is now being called the Sustainable Transition. I brought this book, it's, for those of you in the back, Transition Handbook. Its subtitle is From Oil Dependency to Local Resilience. What a wonderful word, resilience. That's what our communities need if we're going to survive. This is a profoundly appropriate title and subtitle for all of Alaska. I also want to say that Professor David Orr, in his book Ecological Literacy, says something that I think is reflected by the University's Cooperative Extension Service, that we need these following skill bases for our sustainable transition. The transition requires people to know a great deal about solar design, horticulture, waste, composting, greenhouses, intensive gardening, food preservation, household economics, and on-site energy systems. These happen to be almost precisely the skill base and information set available from our Cooperative Extension Service. We have the tools for the sustainable transition, and we have the people with the know-how. Call on us, and we'll show you more.
Questions from Mr. Seifert? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Okay, next, Paul Park.
Bill had talked about using waste energy, and I'm going to take 85, 90-degree glycol and use it to heat another building. By doing this, in the wintertime, our utility is going to save half a megawatt of power just from this savings. This is, for us, this is a lot. This is, we're generating maybe 140 megawatts, and a half a megawatt, that's almost 0.5%. So that's pretty neat. It's a project that we wouldn't have done with our limited maintenance budget, but with the state helping, all our members are going to get to reap the benefits of that. As a homeowner, I would like to say thank you for funding the energy improvements for our homes. I got on board last summer. I got my $7,000 check in probably March, and I saved 250 gallons of fuel oil last winter. So for my home, that's 25% savings. That's a big deal. So please, please keep that up for us. For Mr. Paskevin's idea on the fuel oil help, the incentives, that would be fantastic for the villages and for Fairbanks. And in my opinion, it would have been a lot better use than the $1,200 extra money for everything in the state. Thank you.
Okay. Next, Gary Newman. Welcome.
Well, thank you, and thank you all for coming. My name is Gary Newman, and I've been up in Alaska since the early 70s. I worked for Tanana Chiefs as a weatherization, energy, and housing. I've been out to the villages at a time when a barrel stove burning green wood just to be able to slow it down was the main method of heat, and the most advanced you saw were blaze kings that were mostly melted from overheating. We put out hundreds of wood stoves. We put out Toyo stoves at a time when they were pretty brand new, got folks trained as to how to maintain them. The sort of low-tech, in a sense, getting out to the villages to do something that's sustainable within their own communities. I've enjoyed listening to folks that testified before. Dave Gardner spoke about a lot of good things, I thought. But when it started talking about diversification of energy and meaning our fuel sources needed to include things like coal, I'm actually late for a Golden Valley board meeting where they're discussing investing another $100 million in the experimental coal plant in Healy over the $300 to $400 million that's already been spent. For a 30-year investment, looking at the regulatory climate that's going to tend to discourage that sort of thing, I question that the judgment of going forward on such projects like that. The idea of renewables that are sustainable are a very good idea. Back in probably 85, 86, I had a discussion with Rick Halford about that, who was in the legislature, and we were talking about thinking long-term, and 20 years was his idea of long-term. Well, we're past that point now, and we've made just about zip progress. What you folks did again last year in putting money toward conservation was absolutely phenomenal. It was really, as someone said, a very good first step. In terms of trying to address climate change, in 1989,
House Concurrent Resolution 56 passed the legislature that instructed the governor's office to investigate ways to reduce global warming impacts as well as mitigation. A draft report was prepared. What was contained in it said, again, we should diversify our fuel sources and burn more coal. I don't think they got the idea, and it never went any further. I really think that to the extent possible, we should concentrate on our renewables. We talked about, Senator Stevens, you asked a question about clean coal, what that means. It is cleaner coal, less particulates. There is no commercially no commercial project out there that is actually sequestering carbon dioxide. And when you do that, you will also be reducing the amount of energy that you get out of it because it costs energy to put it in, much like oil shale takes a heck of a lot of water and consumes 30% of the energy just in being able to get it to a process where you can produce whatever it is you're trying to produce. Conservation, renewables, that's, I think, where you need to focus. A lot of this other stuff, there's a lot of experimental stuff out there. If you have an unlimited budget, knock yourselves out. If you don't have an unlimited budget, focus on the things that are going to be best in the long term, and I'm talking much longer term than 20 years. I'll just close it there and go dash off to Golden Valley meeting. Thank you very much for coming again.
Okay, appreciate it. Just a reminder to the folks, we've quite a few people left. If you could try to keep it at 5 minutes, we'd appreciate it. Roger Burgras. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Roger Burgras. I reside at 830 Sheep Creek Road, Fairbanks, Alaska. I've been in the natural resource industry for many years now, and natural resources are what makes this country and is going to allow us to maintain our standard of living. Alaska needs to develop an aggressive plan to solve its energy needs. We have become complacent with cheap oil, and our country, Alaska, has not looked down the road for, you know, the long term. In the rail belt, Anchorage has been fortunate to have gas, cheap gas. Fairbanks has had to rely on oil, which was cheap at one time, and then coal. We also have the rail belt has the benefit of hydroelectric power, which is also the cheapest power that's being produced now. Southeast Alaska has been very fortunate in having hydroelectric power, which has been cheap, and they didn't realize how much they were benefiting until the landslides shut down their transmission lines. Southwest Alaska has tremendous potential for geothermal, and the rural villages have really taken it the brunt of the high prices. There are solutions out there with wind power and possibly solar to a limited degree. Hopefully, propane is going to be made available, which will help them be able to subsist. Also, in the rural areas, they're trying to develop technology for wood burning, and you know, so they have some real problems to deal with. Alaska is a storehouse of energy. We have coal, oil, coal, gas, natural gas, biomass, wind, hydroelectric, and geothermal. You know, if we had a plan, we wouldn't have a problem. We could have plenty of energy, and we all could be living a better lifestyle. The U.S. has failed to develop any kind of comprehensive energy plan, and I am very hopeful that the legislature and with the governor is going to develop a comprehensive plan for Alaska. The short-term picture, you know, there are three areas that we need to look at, short-term, mid-term, and long-term. Short-term, at least for Fairbanks, is the Healy Clean Coal Plant. When that goes into operation, sure, the power may be a little more expensive than the main plant down there, but it's a steady, strong source of power. Wind and solar is fine, but the trouble is it's not defendable. The midterm is, I feel, the natural gas blowing line. You know, I'd love to see that 48-inch line built, but I don't think it's going to happen. But I know Anchorage is facing some real problems now, and we need to get a cheap source of power. Now, the long-term picture, I feel, is Susitna, and that's what the legislature should be looking at now. If we would have acted in 1980, we'd have cheap power now. And, you know, the talk that we're going to have to just accept expensive power, I don't think with the resources that we have up here, if we develop them properly, we can have inexpensive power that's going to allow us to be able to maintain a decent standard of living. We don't have to be a bunch of misers. I say conserve energy, but there is plenty of power and energy in this state, and we need to do something about it. Now, you know, with the bulk line, a lot of people, naysayers, are saying, well, you know, they can't justify building it because there's not a market for it. But I think once that gas line gets built, we are going to be able to utilize all the power all the gas that's being produced. And, you know, we talked about gas to liquids. You know, we can't be dependent on petroleum products forever, and the prices are going to fluctuate. And petroleum products are getting very expensive. So we need to look down the road. I think the gas to liquids, coal to liquids project has a lot of potential. There's a large mine that may be developed out at Livengood that could be bigger than Fort Knox. If that bolt line goes down through there, by gosh, there's all the power they need to develop the facilities, generate the power, and benefit there. So I personally feel that if we do some good planning, we can get something accomplished. I don't want to see Susitna fall behind the cracks. We've spent millions of dollars trying to, you know, to plan for that, and it was killed because certain elements in our state said they didn't want cheap power because that would develop too much resources. So this is a resource state. People are dependent on jobs, and if we're going to have a better lifestyle and be able to provide for our children, we need to do something that is going to help all Alaskans benefit. So I thank you very much for the opportunity to talk here today. I could talk about this for hours because I'm very passionate about our developing our natural resources in the state so that we'll have jobs for our kids.
Thank you, Mr. Burgraff. We appreciate your testimony. Question?
Madam Chair.
Representative Rammers.
I'm with Roger. I like everything he said, especially that bullet line stuff. It's not inventive, but it's spot on, 100%. I'm with Roger.
Yep, that's good. Thank you very much. Really great testimony. Okay, next. I hope I say the last name right. Frank Abig?
Yes.
Is that right? Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you for being here and offering us this opportunity to discuss energy. The community has been very active through the Fairbanks Economic Development and North Star Borough the last few years to try to figure out a roadmap for the interior. And it's also spilled off to the Rail Belt area and in rural Alaska. It is a big deal, energy. My background is about 40 years in energy. I'm an engineer, worked in power plants, and as a consultant, been at almost every facility in Alaska, hydro, nuclear, not nuclear. There is one nuclear, though, but it's mothball. And I think Jesse brings a good view from the Environmental Center. I think all of us really would like to have our energy to be reliable. That means 24/7. Golden Valley does a good job. I think they're only off the line about 2 hours an hour, 2 hours a year. If it was 0 hours, they'd be charging too much and paying too much money to make sure everything worked right, perfect. Energy efficiency. I think we all can relate to that. We hate to waste energy. You know, low cost cars. And I do appreciate the state putting money in toward energy efficiency, helping us improve our homes in conservation. We want low-cost energy, which is the dilemma. I agree with many of the speakers that our energy costs are going to be rising in the future. Renewable energy, I really believe in it. I'm just having trouble wondering if I'm on the leading edge or the bleeding edge of technology. And when you're on the bleeding edge, you spend a lot of money for not a lot of power. And I think we're there, but it's going to take government subsidies and more practice to get us where we need to be. Reducing CO2. I'm not going to tell you whether I am or not against. I'm not sure about global warming personally. I'm working on reading as much as I can, but as an engineer, I'm a skeptic. My problem. But as far as interior Alaska and the rail belt, we do need to move toward renewables to reduce our dependency on oil and coal, and we'd like to get gas. The bullet line is the midterm plan for us. Conservation is our primary goal right now to try to reduce our demand. But the really big project out there that would achieve the 50% renewable, which is an admirable goal, is the Susitna Hydro Dam. It's the only renewable out there that has storage. Storage provides you energy 24/7. It backs you up when the sun's not shining, and there isn't a lot of sun here at 40 below. And the wind. Wind is variable. And a good wind site is only blowing about a third of the time. So Susitna is the one. If we're really going to get serious about reliability and having renewable and reducing CO2, it's Susitna. And as an Alaskan, we all know we store our fuel in different places, the wood pile over here, the wood pile over there, because at 40 below, we have to have the backup. If you think of the military thinks the same way. What does the military burn at their coal plants? Or at their plants at Eielson and Fort Wainwright, they burn coal because they can go down there to the mine and get it. I think coal is part of our plan. It is our wood pile. It is our backup. And we are a long way from each other. And I think coal needs to be part of it. That's all I have.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Frank, for your testimony. As you look, as you mentioned, Susitna would be, in your mind, the best solution for the rail belt. What do you see as long-term solutions for southeastern Alaska, southwestern Alaska, the rural areas?
The gas line that would come off the North Slope has gas liquids, may have propane. I think that would be a valuable fuel for smaller communities on the rail road system and also in western Alaska. As far as southeast, they do have hydro, quite a bit of hydro from the Four Dam Pool, and they have it. That's their main resource right there.
Thank you very much. And I want to acknowledge Mayor Jim Whitaker is in the room over there. And Mayor Whitaker, did you want to say anything?
Fine, thank you.
Okay, thank you for having us in your town here. And also to acknowledge that Brian Rogers was named the permanent chancellor today, and to congratulate him. Okay, and next we're going to go to Mr. Dan White.
Thank you, Dan. Dan White, I'm director of the Institute of Northern Engineering here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and I would just like to thank you very much for being here, and thank you for supporting in the FY10 budget the funds for the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. And we look forward to working with you and developing energy solutions for communities around Alaska and for economic development in the state. Thank you very much for your efforts.
That's great. Thank you. Very nice. And thanks for hosting us today. We enjoyed touring around. Next, Mr. Brian Ellingson from the Tanana Valley campus.
Madam Chair, if you don't mind, I'm Rick Caulfield. I'm director for UAF's Tanana Valley campus, and Professor Brian Ellingson and I'd like to make a joint presentation.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much. We're here first and foremost to encourage you to incorporate a very critical factor into any sort of state energy policy, and that is workforce development, putting Alaskans to work in relationship to any development of energy resources. Here at University of Alaska Fairbanks, Tanana Valley campus, we spend a lot of time looking at Department of Labor information and talking with industry and labor about emerging trends for workforce development. And I've actually put some materials out in front of you, so I hope you have a chance to take a look at the types of programs that our campus and many other community campuses and regional training centers around the state are working with. And those are programs like diesel heavy equipment and welding, process technology, instrumentation, power generation, automotive technology. And our point here is to ensure that those needs, the needs for developing opportunities, career pathways for Alaskans to get into these critical jobs for Alaska's future are incorporated into energy policy. When we look at the growth sectors here in the Alaskan economy, oil and gas, obviously, mining, utilities development, construction, these are exactly the types of job opportunities that are available to our students. And Commissioner Bishop, Commissioner of Labor, I see, is here, and he's very effective in talking about two critical factors in our workforce in Alaska. Number one is the very significant numbers of dollars that go out of state every year, the number of out-of-state workers who come in to work in these sectors. And secondly, a graying workforce. And I get up every morning, look in the mirror, and I figure I'm the poster child for the graying workforce. And we know that there are really many, many good opportunities out there for our young people. And so the critical factor is to work with our high schools, our middle schools, and into post-secondary education to provide career pathways into these vital jobs. And with that, what I'd like to do is turn this over to Professor Brian Ellingson. And let me just say a quick note about Brian. Brian teaches with our process technology program here in Fairbanks, and we were extraordinarily lucky to get him. He's been 20 years in the process industry, 17 years working with Flint Hills Resources. And he's also joined by Don Bickmeyer, who taught at Lathrop High School, I think it was back in the 1960s, technology, went to work for Alyeska Pipeline Service Company for 30 years, retired, and then came back and is now teaching with our process technology program. So I couldn't be happier with the quality of experienced faculty that we have teaching in our process technology program. And I'll turn it over to Brian and let him say a few words about that.
Thank you very much for this opportunity, and I'd just like to make you aware of the process technology associate degree program if you're not already aware of it, and those information materials will help also. The encouraging part of this program is the fact that it's a general degree, and that it applies itself really well to several different parts of the industry. And we've found, and I've found, that the base knowledge, the base skills that they're getting with this process technology degree program sets them up with knowledge about equipment, about instrumentation, about controls, and about the human factor involved in these processes and how to make them work more efficiently and last longer. And those seem like really important parts of a successful project to me. And also the importance of setting up individuals or setting up industries with good trained employees that know what they're doing with these processes and that can offer advice on optimization, that type of thing. I learned here just recently at the Biomass Heating Symposium just how kind of wide and varied these different projects are out there, especially with the rural communities. But the interesting part for me was when I sit back and look at all these processes is just how common the equipment is, the control systems, and all of the operations that happen around each one of those different types of systems, from especially biomass, where we're everything from a cordwood style boiler to a chip fed boiler, that type of thing. Also, I'd like to make you aware that the Artana Valley Campus Process Technology Program is flexible, and we like to think a little bit nimble, and we try to stay current with industry and with research and with things that are happening in the community now and in the future. So our students are stay in touch with these projects that are happening out there. And in that folder, you'll see a picture of a wind turbine that our students put together here in the last school year. And it was a project that they took on themselves, and turned out to be very successful, totally hand-built and amazing. And just how simple the technology is, but how much they learned and how excited they got putting this type of project together. So appreciate the opportunity to talk with you a little bit and help you learn a little bit more about our program.
Excellent. Thank you. Questions? Okay. Appreciate your testimony and your work. Keep us updated. Okay, next we'll go to, it looks like Michael Kraft. The last two letters I can't see. Okay. Great. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Mike Kraft, and I'm here representing Alaska Environmental Power. I'm a managing partner, and we also were one of the grant recipients from House Bill 152, and I want to thank you for that. And brought you a couple pictures. This is the turbine that we put in last year out of our pocket, and this is the hole where your turbine's going. And hopefully by the end of September we'll be at 1 megawatt. And today we signed the interconnection agreement with Golden Valley. So we're on our way. And I'm a land developer. I've been here since the early 70s. And about 4 years ago I saw an opportunity, and it had to do with renewable energy. And I noticed nobody was really doing anything about it. So I thought, well, I'll get tuned in here and see if I can make a run at this as a business. And one of the things that I kind of relied on was my land development experience. And that comes where people don't want stuff in their backyard. You know, they don't want condominiums over here, and they don't want this over there. And, you know, so there's all kinds of conflicting land use issues out there. And so far, that was probably one of the largest hurdles to develop renewable energy in Alaska. And a lot of it came from DNR. You know, I've been around here a long time and went a lot of places where I noticed a lot of things. And the last 4 years, I've been looking at wind. And one of the things I've noticed is they talk about additional grid capacity. And I know where there's probably 8 different spots right now where the grid is there, the wind is there, but the land's owned by the government. And so I started trying to negotiate with the government 3 years ago, Wind Aquifee down in Anchorage with DNR, about developing some of these wind sites. And that we own. And to this day, I've gotten zero response to this day. Okay? There's no plan. There's talk of a wind royalty. In other words, there's talk of, okay, we'll go out there and do all the work, and once you prove something, then we want to own that information, and we might negotiate some kind of contract with you on the land. The same thing applies to title. we've come up with some pretty interesting title designs. And where do you find a piece of land that's on the title design line? Who owns that? State of Alaska, federal government. And so I want to make sure that you guys realize that we've got the areas right now that we could develop renewable energy wind farms. And if we had four or five different wind farms in four or five different parts of the interior, that 30% capacity factor now goes to about 60%, because it's not always windy in Healy, and it's not always windy in Delta, and it's not always windy at Summit Lake. But it's windy somewhere pretty much all the time. And so there's a chance to build a system like that right now with the current infrastructure that we have in place, 15 to 20 megawatt little farms all over the place. And right now, with the federal government kicking in 30% capital reimbursement in 2010 for anything that's built in 2010, they take a third of the price tag off of a wind farm if you build in 2010. When you do the math, and you've got a 30% capacity factor facility, and you do the math with 30% off that the federal government's going to kick back in, it pencils out with Golden Valley's avoided fuel costs. It makes money. So it's something for the private sector to get into. But the problem comes back to, how do you get to the stuff? You know, you got to build a road. Who's gonna dictate what kind of road, and who's gonna help you with the rights of ways? How are we gonna get access even to Eva Creek Golden Valley's project right now? State land. They don't have a lease. They should have a lease, and I think they should be moving forward with that project. But there's a lot of issues out there that boil down to where the tire meets the road. The technology is here. The resources here, guys like me are out there, and we're building wind farms. I put in 70,000 kilowatt hours last year into the Railbelt grid. We'll be at 1 megawatt by the end of the summer, thanks to the AEA 152 goal. After that, I don't know where this is going. I've got GE willing to finance $30 million worth of turbines, but I don't have a customer. If I had a better wind site, i.e. some of the places out there, like, for example, the road to Pogo Mine. The top of that mountain out there, that's a windy spot. It's 3,000 feet. There's a dedicated road to it. There's a 138,000-volt line runs right by the wind site. You can't use it. You can't even get anybody to tell you what the rules would be or might be. And so what I'd like to, for you folks to do maybe is think about where the tire meets the road, make these areas accessible to people that want to go out there and do this work. And the private sector will step in. But, you know, we can't do anything if we don't have access to at least the land. And so that's been a real issue for us. But I do want to thank you for your insight in House Bill 152, and it was very, we're going to try to make you proud.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony. Intriguing. Questions? Okay, thank you. Okay, next we're going to go to Luke Hopkins. And just because we're not responding or asking questions doesn't mean that we're not thinking about what you're saying. We're processing it, and it will likely come back up again in our continued discussions. It's just that there's only so much time. So I want to make sure that you know this is a thoughtful group that would be asking lots of questions if we had the entire day. So thank you. Go ahead.
And thank you, Senator McGuire, and other senators and representatives here. I appreciate you coming to Fairbanks and enjoying our nice warm weather. The local elected representatives know how it is here in the summer, so they're sharing it with you. I am a elected official on the Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly, and I am also a board member for the Alaska Gas Line Port Authority. And, of course, we've been working towards first open season under AGEA, and we'll be continuing on that path. But, you know, we've all probably seen the ad from 1958, I believe it's a Fairbanks newspaper ad that shows a gas line from Prudhoe Bay to the Prince William Sound, and on it is a small flame saying that gas line coming soon, basically, and 50 years later, that flame is still there. And I certainly hope that we get to increase the volume on that flame. And but from where I am here, and we're all here this summer, we look back at the actions that the legislature has taken, the Senate has taken, and I want to thank you for that action. The energy efficiency funding that you put forward, the grant funding to continue work on renewable projects, and your, of course, your big piece was the energy assistance bill during special session. That, even though it wasn't put in place, that was a very progressive piece that actually was a bridge to help all of the citizens with their heating concerns when the energy costs skyrocketed. But what that leads to is I ask you to continue to be bold, and be bold soon. I hope that you start in January and work on the pile of energy bills that you have, and things get passed in that next 90-day session. That's important actions to get this state moving. That hopefully will start forming that vision that we need to move our state forward. When you take aim at it, fire a number of rounds at it so that you successfully hit that 50% renewable resource goal. And you can hit it sooner the more rounds you fire at it, I think. So we lost the $20 million or $29 million energy funding that was in the capital project, and that was really disappointing. That's an energy efficiency piece, and I hope some action's taken, whether it's state funds or you can actually go back and reach back to get those funds. But you know, these are pieces that the state needs to keep putting forward. And when you hear what the University of Alaska needs to continue to look at energy solutions for our state, I ask you to be bold and fund those. You just heard $500,000 in what I believe is the FY10 budget. Good, and I thank you for that. But I ask you to be bold and put more into it. On the state level, Alaska must be spending dollars on energy infrastructure. We just heard about where should the roads be? What should the right-of-ways be? How can we reach our renewable energies that are out there? The state needs to spend money on this infrastructure, big time. Be bold again. Fairbanks has been aiming at our own solution. We've had to move quickly when the energy costs skyrocketed. Fairbanks has an energy plan, and I can send this to you. The mayor can send it to you if you haven't seen it. We adopted it into our economic development strategy. This is how we hope to get to a solution for the cost of energy and the type of energy that we use in our community. Susitna is one. Susitna is very, very important. Again, that's the infrastructure that you need to be bold on and spend the money on. If you went up to, I'm not sure how many of you went up to Chena Hot Springs today, you probably heard very, very strongly about smokestack-free energy opportunities. Well, here in our plan, in the Fairbanks plan, we have that smokestack-free one, and it's using a very viable source of energy. It's coal, and it's smokestack-free. You already heard from people talking about it. We can sequester or look at sequestering and ensuring we sequester all the carbon dioxide from that. We need to look at that. It takes a little bit of money to keep looking at it and then have it evaluated. The Tanana Chiefs Conference, they're bringing projects to the interior communities. But I think that you need to keep being bold, keep working on what you have, and push the envelope, and I ask you to provide the state funding where it really needs to go. We will also need bridges, and I think we're all familiar with the, I probably don't need to say it, the Bridge to Nowhere, but all of these bridges on energy solutions now until we get to the 50% renewable is a real item, and we can get there. Natural gas, in my mind, is the first one to get out to the state, and you'll have the propane development, and you'll be able to find revenue into the treasury from the natural gas sales. So I thank you again for being here, and again, I offer you the Fairbanks Energy Flex Plan.
That would be great. And if Trevor could get a copy. Thank you, Assemblyman Hopkins. Questions? Yes, Senator Terrio.
Thank you. I'm just wondering if you can give us a little bit of a snapshot on the preparations of the Port Authority to participate in open seasons. I've tried to check to see if dialogue is going on between Port Authority and TransCanada. I've been told that it is, and it's good, meaningful, but are things progressing so that there'll be real participation in open season?
As much as I can say it, because of confidentiality agreements, we have spoken to TransCanada, we the Port Authority. We had a public opportunity in Valdez a few months ago where Tony Palmer came down. We've had a number of written exchanges, both through the state and directly with TransCanada. I think everybody is both waiting and working on that first open season aspect. TransCanada has said to the legislature that they will work on that leg of the major pipeline, depending on volumes, to Valdez for an LNG connection. And that's the point that the Port Authority is wanting TransCanada to stay focused on. That may be the only amount that is a viable project in the first open season. The our partners are also making contact with TransCanada. They are a global energy corporation, and they're probably having their own conversations, but that's probably about as far as I can go on that one. First open season, though, that's the work that has to get done to prepare to submit for that in about a year from now, I hope. But I hope that answers your question.
Thank you very much. Okay, next I have Larry Landry.
I mean, these are big issues, but to my mind, it's beyond the call to take this much time from the summer and go and do these things, so really appreciate it. A lot of people talking about renewables and supporting it, and I think that's great. I applaud that, and while I have you all here, I want to thank the Interior legislators that have supported the good bills and the legislature. I don't know where you guys stand on it, so I can't thank you. The man from GBA, I think it was Dave Gardner, was his name, was talking about conservation and efficiency as the first way to go, says, I think it's really important. One thing that you don't hear very much in that discussion that I wanted to touch on, and I think you don't hear it because it's a very un-Alaskan concept, and that is that small is beautiful. You look around Fairbanks, and I guess I can't say what it's like down that way, being a patriotic Interior resident. I don't go out there very often. but we have the same big home mania that has happened all across the country, and big homes are ill-suited to Alaska, period, Interior Alaska in particular. People here for the longest time lived in small homes, and there was a very obvious reason for that. The first way that we can save energy is to live in smaller dwellings and drive smaller vehicles. That said, it is a wildly un-Alaskan concept. As I said, I know the legislature can't be like, okay, you know, you can't build a home over 1,200 square feet now. That's not what's going to, that won't fly. But I think what would fly is education related to just, you build a home this big, and this is what your energy bill is going to be. You know, you get the best insulation, best energy efficient technologies. This is what it's going to cost you, roughly, depending on oil prices. This is what it would cost you to build a smaller place. It is an intelligent way to go, I think. And I think maybe incorporating that idea of just education into whatever energy legislation gets put out there, I think would be very helpful. I wanted to touch on hydro, and I haven't penciled these out. I'm not an expert in these things, but I'm not a fan of Susitna. Susitna is a big, destructive project. It is renewable, but it will bury a lot of land.
I like Chacachamba. For a very small dam, a very small footprint, it's still a very large project. I think it's in the order of 300 megawatts, and it costs a lot less money, and it delivers a lot of power. And I for me, that's a preferable, I think, a better first step, and then let's see where we are from there. But I think that's, for me, that's a better way to go. Coal. The discussion of coal has come up a few times, and I wanted to touch on that. The science of climate change gets short shrift, at least in interior Alaska, and I suspect out in the rest of the state as well. And the scientific evidence that it is happening and that it's human-caused is becoming ever more powerful. I can't remember the exact words, but I was looking at a recent NOAA report. Well, I say recent, it actually somehow snuck out during the Bush administration. And it basically said, and this is a quote, the overwhelming majority of peer-reviewed studies, that is a quote, hold that the planet is warming and that it is human-caused. There is much speculation as to how serious those consequences are, but they are potentially very serious. Other than peat, coal is the most inefficient, the most carbon-intensive fuel on the planet. Until we can learn to sequester coal, there is no clean coal, and I think that until the coal sequestration technologies are in place, I don't think coal is the way that we need to move forward. Once they do, I think we all jump on the coal bandwagon and have a big party. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions? Senator Cherio.
Thank you. Your opposition to Susitna, a lot of times people talk about Susitna as if it were one dam, one huge reservoir. And my remembrance is it's a possibility of three or four different dams built in different sequences and different potential heights. So when you express opposition, is it to that entire concept of a number of different dams? It could be one or two. So what is your opposition?
The way that I heard it explained at a meeting in Olean on this maybe 3, 4, 5 months ago, it said that dam number one, the Watama Dam, would be the first way that you go, and that is by far and away the biggest mountain. I think that was the one that in and of itself would cover one of the dams, especially if you already remember. And that was the one that for me would be of most concern. The other ones have some of this. I thought it was two that they mentioned, and the second one had a much smaller footprint. For me, I mean, we've got to look at these things because hydro has to come before coal.
Okay, thank you very much. Next, Carl Manretti. My apologies if I didn't get it right. Welcome.
My legs aren't as nice as Jesse's, but I wore shorts anyway. Thank you again for coming and the opportunity to speak before you. I just wanted to mention some support for the two bills that the House bill presented, Bill 150 to create an energy emergency and emerging energy technology fund, and the other one about SB 121, creating energy efficient buildings. About the emerging energy technology fund, while I strongly support this bill, I suggest that not at all of the money be used to examine possibilities for clean coal and coal to liquids. The reason I say that, I'm certain that those things need to be looked into, but the price tags I've seen on them could eat up your whole budget. The next proposed phase of looking into the clean or to the coal to liquids plant would be about $10 million in and of itself, and to build such a plant would be $5 to $7 billion, and that's without cost overruns. It would take 5 to 10 years to get it built, and it would be putting carbon dioxide into the air for generations to come. Carbon dioxide sequestration has not, as somebody earlier said, there's no commercial coal sequestration out there, CO2 sequestration out there that works yet, and all the potentials that are that I've heard mentioned cost an awful lot of money and would eat up
30 to 50% of the energy generated anyway. Even with the Healy plant now, Gary Newman earlier said that they had already spent $300 to $400 million and are looking about spending another $100 million now to try to bring that up to standards. Boy, if we could turn that kind of money toward renewable energy, I think we'd be a lot farther ahead. What I would suggest doing is take that money and invest it in developing wind farms, run-of-river electric generation, geothermal and biomass generation for the villages. Most of the villages in interior Alaska, at least, are on large rivers, and there's a tremendous potential for run-of-river electric generation. I know some of you might be thinking about the current disaster in Eagle, where everything in the river and next to the river was wiped out. But that could be obviated by the fact that there's a three-week window of maintenance on a yearly basis that these things have to be taken out of the river and maintained, and that could be done before breakup and left out until after breakup is completed. Of course, the existing diesel generation in most of the villages would have to remain in place for backup, but it would not have to be utilized near the extent that it is now. If we removed the subsidies on natural gas and oil and coal and instead supported the development of large-scale wind, solar, and geothermal and tidal electric generation capacity for the rail belt, Mike Kraft mentioned the possibility of them wanting to charge a royalty on wind. As far as I know, there's not even a royalty paid to the state for coal. I might be wrong there, but I think that's just taken for... What's that? Okay, thanks for correcting me on that. We keep hearing that renewables can never replace Alaska's current oil, natural and coal resources, natural gas and coal resources for power generation. It does seem that most of the people we hear that from are from the fossil fuel industry. I think there's a lot more potential out there than people give it credit for. And we'll always need oil and natural gas, but we shouldn't need to rely on them completely for space heating and electrical generation. Renewable energy sources are all local. We do not have to fight wars to keep the sun shining or the wind blowing. We do not have to pay hostile nations for hot water from the earth or moving water in our rivers and oceans. We do not have to send our energy dollars out of the state. The money saved on buying fossil fuels stays here in our local economy, and we do not have to cope with CO2 production or other potentially harmful byproducts from our energy production. Regarding creating energy-efficient buildings, this is one of the simplest things we can possibly do to ensure a lower cost of energy. Surely the cheapest unit of energy is the one you don't use. A recent study by the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation indicated that 68% of the cost of energy used in the Fairbanks North Star Borough was for space heating. This is the low-hanging fruit. New construction to highly energy-efficient standards, costing maybe 3 to 10% more upfront, can save 30 to 50% in operation and maintenance costs for the life of the building. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation Weatherization and Energy Retrofit Programs that you folks put into place last year have proved the effectiveness of retrofitting these homes, or many homes. In many cases, people are experiencing fuel savings of 30 to 50% over previous years. Paul Park mentioned 25% on his house. Last year, the Northern Alaska Environmental Center did an energy retrofit, and that's saving us 40% right now over a yearly basis. Both the Interior Issues Council Cost of Energy Task Force and the Climate Change Task Force came to similar conclusions. The first step toward reducing the cost of energy to the consumer and to help mitigate climate change is energy conservation and efficiency. Our state cannot afford to be without strict building codes, despite what the governor might think, that demand the highest quality materials, energy-efficient methods, and craftsmanship be incorporated into every public building. There's no simpler place to begin. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions? Okay, next we'll go to Mike Smith, and we have five people left to testify, and we have 25 minutes left. So if you wanted to abbreviate your testimony and submit it in writing, that would be great. Any help we could get, we'd appreciate. Mike Smith?
Thank Chair, members, the legislature, welcome to Fairbanks. I'm glad we had a wonderful day for you here. My name is Mike Smith. I work for Tana Chiefs Conference. And as you well know, Tana Chiefs Conference is the worst economic distressed area in this country. We like to make the point when we talk to people that you can look anywhere in the United States, and the worst people off are right here in the interior portion of Alaska. We want to make that point because we want to make sure that when the state develops a statewide energy plan that they don't forget us. We've heard a lot of talk here today and over the course of the last year about these great energy projects that are intended to alleviate some of the burden that the Rail Belt areas carry. We heard Governor Palin, excuse me, I get a little impassioned about this simply because we're in such dire straits out there. We've heard Governor Palin say that she wants to have renewable energy, 50% renewable energy in this state by a certain time. We are afraid that that's going to come out of the Rail Belt, that the people in rural areas are slowly dying on the vine. While it's nice to talk about, you know, hundreds of million dollars for dam projects and stuff, it's not really glamorous to talk about a $1 million project for Shagaluk that has 100 people in it, but is paying well over a dollar a kilowatt hour, $5 or $6 a gallon for gas and diesel. We look at it as simply not necessarily energy relief, but as economic equity. We spend a lot of time and effort in this state to provide economic incentive for the oil companies, for the mining companies, and so on and so forth. What we would like to see is a little economic incentive for the small business owner in rural Alaska. And the way we can do that cheaply, or not cheaply, but the way we think that the state of Alaska should take care of that is through an adequate energy policy that reflects the needs of rural Alaska. The thing that made Alaska great, that is rural Alaska and rural living, is slowly dying on the vine. And as we sit here and watch it go away, we think that we at TCC think that that is not exactly what the state should be doing. The other thing with the energy policy that we're finding out at Tana Chiefs Conference is, like I said, we represent 42 communities. Trying to provide cheap energy to all those communities under the tight time frames that we have for this energy expenditures over the next few years, we anticipate a lot of this energy money being gone within a few years. And if we don't effectively utilize that money in rural Alaska, we will, or at least I will, have not done my job. And to a certain extent, I think the legislature may not have done their job as well. One of the things that became pretty apparent to us when the state first started with their $300 million, as well as the stimulus package funding, was we didn't have the expertise to attend the Chiefs Conference. We don't have the engineers, and we don't have the alternative energy experts that we, of course, wish we had. We certainly can't afford to have those type of people. So we had to go looking for help. There, like I said, I keep pointing this out, we have 42 communities. Each one of those communities is somebody is trying to sell them a bill of goods, trying to sell them a project. Whether that project is good or not, I don't know. Staff at TCC doesn't know. So we had to go looking. And what we ended up doing, and we found a very good partner, we think, in the University of Alaska, Fairbanks here. The Alaska Center for Energy and Power, we've entered into a cooperative arrangement with them. We're going to utilize their expertise in the power generation and the alternative energy fields, as well as our expertise in bringing projects to rural areas of the state. We think that that is the best approach to take in order to make the best, get the best bang for our buck, if you will. We don't want a lot of white elephants sitting out in our villages. While we'll take a lot of money, and there is a lot of money available to our communities, we want to develop in a comprehensive, adequate manner. And we think that a regional-wide approach to our energy needs is where we should start. We've entered in, like I said, into agreement with the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, and we certainly hope to utilize them and their expertise to develop that plan. We are also, one of the other things, though, that became pretty apparent was that the wide variety of money that is available to a community out there. I like using Shagaluk because it's one of my favorite communities. I really like the people in Shagaluk, but it's a really small community, It has very few people, probably less than 100 people now, out in the middle of nowhere. You can't get stuff there. It's just a nightmare to try to deal in. But in Shagluck, we want to assure them that their community doesn't die out. And the only way we're going to be able to do that is through some sound economic policies. We think that alternative or energy resources in rural areas, the lifeblood, like as mentioned earlier, it is the bottom line for all economic development is energy prices. And that's how we look at energy projects in rural Alaska, as simply leveling the economic playing field for those people trying to make a living and trying to live and continue to live in rural areas. I want to publicly thank the university for their help in this endeavor we're working on. We wouldn't be able to do it without them. We certainly hope to see some progressive, comprehensive energy plans and good projects. We don't want to spend a bunch of money and not have anything successful to show for it at the end of that. So, Madam Chairman, thank you once again for coming to Fairbanks. Don't forget rural Alaska. And if there's anything we can certainly do to help, we'll be more than happy to.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Okay, next, Faye Gallant. Orgelant.
Hello, and thank you. My name is Faye Gallant, and I work for Red Oil, which is resisting environmental destruction on indigenous lands. It's an Alaska Native grassroots network. We've got some people all around the state committed to a safe and healthy environment conducive to subsistence. And my role with them is the Tribal Campus Climate Challenge Organizer, which means I work with students around Alaska who are looking to learn more about climate and more about clean energy. I know we do have climate skeptics in the room. I'm not going to try and convince you that climate change is real. I think you've heard all the evidence there is for that, but I'd like you to think about it this way. If you think something might be making you sick, and the overwhelming majority of doctors tell you, yeah, it's probably making you sick, wouldn't you try to limit your exposure to that thing making you sick? Or would you just keep on exposing yourself over and over and over and over and say, eh, well, I'm not 100% sure it's making me sick, so I better keep going. Maybe you're willing to take those risks with your health, but don't take them with mine. With climate change in Alaska, whether you believe in it or not, it's having a disproportionate impact on two communities, indigenous peoples and the youth. Indigenous peoples, because they're so intimately tied to the land that when these changes happen, it has effects on culture, on health, on spirituality, things that we can't measure or quantify. And on youth, because we're the ones who are going to be here 20, 50 years from now when the things start getting worse and start getting worse. We're the ones who are going to have to deal with this, and we're the ones who will have to bear the cost of any changes that need to happen. We're the ones who will have to bear the cost of energy. We're the ones who will have to bear the economic costs of loss of land or loss of land uses, or if you're asking us to take changes towards renewable energy that you think will be more expensive, we're the ones that are going to have to bear those costs in the future. Alaska has the greatest clean and renewable resources of anywhere in the country. And we should be a leader in developing those clean renewable resources and seeing a just transition to a clean energy economy that benefits all of Alaska, not just oil companies and not just big developers down in Anchorage. So that's basically what I'm here to say, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions? Okay. Next, we will go to Tammy Wilson. Welcome.
Hi, and thank you so much for coming. We really do appreciate when you guys come here so we have this opportunity. My name is Tammy Wilson. I'm one of the newer members on the Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly. And so if I say something wrong, I'll apologize now. I have that tendency. I guess I'm here just to say help. You know, I'm glad it's a beautiful day today, but I'm going to take you back to September when you guys were kind enough to give us some money to help us with our energy cost. Well, some went out and they went and they bought some of these outdoor boilers, some that are not EPA regulated at that time. And so if this was let's say December and negative 50, which we all experienced this year, you wouldn't be looking out into this really sunny, clear area. You would be seeing stacks of all sorts of things, from coal to wood to oil to who knows what. So we are now in a non-attainment area with the EPA, which is going to start causing real problems for the borough. So we're having to sit here now as an assembly and try to start figuring out what we should regulate to those people who live here, when in reality, the only thing, in my opinion, and I'm not going to try to outdo these guys because I'm just impressed by all the knowledge that's in this room, is we need something besides oil because of the sulfur and necessarily wood and coal, which is basically gas. We can't wait 10, 20, 30 years because regulations are only going to get tougher. They're going to make it so that we're going to have harder times being able to get transportation monies. And then we're going to be trying to regulate our citizens to do things like not burn wood, which that's not going to happen. But, you know, we're doing it for a purpose, in my opinion, that still will not let us meet what the EPA is trying to tell us to do. So we need your help. We need you to write a letter to the EPA and say you're going to try to get us some help, some gas, so that we can meet these regulations. Because downtown, which is where our sensors are, most of those people burn oil. And what are you going to do, tell them they can't? You know, we just cannot do that. Can we tell people that because of quality of life issues, because the neighbors have allergies or asthma to the smoke, that you're going to have to freeze to death because that's the only option that you have in your home? Because it is about affordable energy. I know it's not cheap, and it's not easy, and you all have a really hard job, and I don't want it, you know, but I'm the one who's going to have to sit in front of these constituents and try to justify what we're going to have to be doing because of the EPA. And I can't do it without you guys, you know, so I'm here to beg, you know, not below that. We need your help. Because I am not a scientist, but I'll tell you one thing. People do the same type of things in their home to heat their homes each and every day, but yet it's only on those negative 30 to negative 50 days that all of a sudden our numbers go over. Well, even I can figure out it's because of the cold. You know, the only people we're polluting are ourselves. You know, we're not Los Angeles or Chicago and blowing it on someone else. We're at least keeping it here, and that's the reality. So, you know, there's nothing we can do to change it except get gas now. So please, in January, take and dust off whatever you have to do. I'm not going to tell you which plan is better because I honestly don't know. But I do know that we cannot keep doing things the way we're doing. We have awesome legislators in our area, and I know they can do it. And I just ask that you please do whatever you can. And thank you for all you do.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions? Thank you. Okay, Lisa Pager. Okay, she's not here. Bob Beach. And that's the last person I have signed up. Welcome,
Mr.
Beach.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. And what a golden opportunity on a day like this is to have some great minds to be able to really do something with this energy future for our, well, for, let's say, your legacy. Let's say your legacy. Your legacy to your future. What is your future? Your younger generation, let's put it that way. Now, we may have an opportunity in this lifetime for us to be able to grant to our kids free energy. What a beautiful design. And you guys are empowered to do this. Free energy for your kids. You're not being, you know, your kids aren't going to be strangled, you know, from a little bit of heat in this climate. In the winter, for them to be able to throw a switch in their warm, or a toaster, hot dogs, or whatever kids eat. In the world of money, you get what you pay for. You ask a scientist, what is going to be the result of this and that? You will get whatever you pay for. Whoever funds it, they will get the money for it. Why do I know this? I live in Fairbanks. Let me just resolve it at that. But if you don't mind, there is, you know, some of the alternative energies that are on the horizon. They're graspable. They're like on top of boiler generators. There's magnetic generator motors these are all viable. They're, from what I understand, they work. What a beautiful thing for a child of your future to be able to say, hey, this isn't too bad. This isn't too bad. Guess who did this for me? Guess who? Now, take it into your hands and do this. Resolve it one way or the other. Fund the kids of the future to sponsor them to where these possibilities are of the alternative energy. They're young enough in the junior high. They're young enough. They're smart enough, you know, to come back and explain to us just exactly what's what and how it should be. Just for you to decide, you know, hey, let's do it. Let's. Winter's coming. They say it's 90 days, but I know better. I live in Fairbanks. Believe me, that weather is not going to go away. And so for, you know, just a legacy, just something to look at. Please understand it as something for your future generations. Let's look at it. Let's have it resolved. But none of this can happen unless we have a smelter. We have all this opportunity of clean energy to be able to design 27 tons of steel that capture the wind for the flip of the switch or whatever your heart delights. You know, that idea can be possible, but you can't build 27 tons of steel. But an opportunity such as Alaska with the resources and possibilities of extra added renewables at this low cost in time, especially some of the smelters that are available now at bankruptcy rates, it would be possible to have something in place and engineered within 4 years for us to capture the tax that's offered. And we could, it's possible with some of the energy money that you guys can provide in a fashion to be able to have this so that there's one of the hurdles that is met with this energy situation. I would appreciate it also if there was a little consideration for the rural areas for them to be able to get some of this extra added credits for providing some of these energies within their means. And I appreciate their time and effort and your qualifications. I admire you guys. Your position.
Thank you very much. Thank you as well.
Chair?
Yes.
Lisa Pegger's my constituent. She just re-entered the room.
All right. Welcome. You're our last speaker.
Mr. Van Wonderman, I appreciate that. My belief is that oil is abiotic. You've got hydrogen and carbon. They're some of the biggest components of the Earth's crust and atmosphere. And with heat and pressure and time, you have a fount of energy. And just a fact there for you. The energy markets were 30% manipulated by hedge funds, large fuel storage tanks with names like Morgan Stanley on the side. We're part of the culture of corruption that made the price go up 300%. And the deal about the shale gas being going to throw off AGEA, shale gas is very expensive. It has to be mostly exploded. Mostly BP has the shale gas leases, so it's not like that's an American company in particular. So there's a lot of other distributors that will be interested in our gas, and and it's under populated areas that won't want the arsenic and the land tapped that way. And so there's a lot of disinformation coming down the pike about that. And we should use our permanent fund for in-state energy because it will rally up for a little bit and then go down again because the stock market is highly overvalued still yet at this point because of manipulations with the interest rates and the fact that even without the lack of confidence in equities, the demographics of the age groups of people in this country, the lion's share of them, people don't need the types of stores that are in this country now. They already have two of everything, and they're selling off as people age and retire, and they don't need the Limiteds and the Gaps and all the different things that we have way too much of. And so you're going to have all these equities go down, and you know, over the course of time, we'd be much better off, since equities will be flat for a huge portion of time, and will go down to about 84% off, because the fundamentals in the economy are worse now than they were during the Great Depression, as far as the amount of debt and indebtedness that American taxpayers are put on the hook for, which is up to $100 trillion when you add all indebtedness and the credit default swaps and the things that are hidden from us in the banking situation. So the thing is, you may as well take that money and invest it in things that, you know, we could have pilot plants of algal biodiesel. Algal biodiesel is better in the cold than elsewhere, because we have, where it's cold, the lipids in the algae are a higher content. So there's, it goes from 60% being fat and usable as diesel to a higher percentage, so you can actually grow it here. And there are people who, you know, you go out for it and find these people who are trying to do pilot plants with technology that's, you know, already engineered to the bankable stage. But since the credit market kind of bottomed out in the bond market, and there's not much money since the Federal Reserve scooped it all off the table, they're having, you know, problems finding money for these startups. But if we took our fund, which, you know, like I say, when it rallies up, sell out and bring it to energy projects for Alaska, and then you'll be able to take care of your energy needs and have a sure investment. And then there's also things like forest management of the decadent trees to be used before it gets burned up by wasting energy and smoking us out, because you all know about the Alaska Forest Refinery Project. You know, there's not a better forest management plan in the world, and you're wasting those trees. There's energy. It's like having a 50-foot silo of solar energy stored up that's just going to burn anyway, and so you may as well harvest it, because what they do there is harvest 1% on a 50-year rotation, just the diseased and decadent trees, and they replant with a hardier stock, so you have a better forest, less chance of it going up in smoke before your eyes and wasting it. And I'll get back to that some more too. I'm skipping around here. You should have a cap before fuel prices become unmanageable again. And in lieu of that, if you want a more conservative way to get into that, you could have the state-owned fuel tanks that brings competition where there is none, because we have non-competitive markets. But if the, like for instance, GBA could say, well, I want to rent this much space for this much fuel, and they don't have to buy the refinery fuel, that drives the refinery's price down in times when they're gouging and they don't need to. And so you could have, you know, big buyers doing things like that. And and the state would just own it so that it couldn't be bought out from underneath them. And but they would just lease the space, and then people who wanted to could, you know, utilize that to bring competition to a non-competitive market. Okay, one thing you could do, the pipelines being shut down all the time cost money to the state, because there is no mechanism or lever to make the oil companies use the best available corrosion coating. There are now nanotech coatings that are available that don't create corrosion like what you have now being used. And let's see. The, getting on here, sorry about that. the coal to liquids plant is the third dip into public monies for coal to liquid, and the, let's compare that with the forest refinery. The yield of liquid fuel is exactly the same. The cost of the fuel is four times as much with the coal to liquid plant, and the cost of the plant itself is 20 to 36 times, depending on if you're talking $5 billion or $9 billion, what the forest refinery would be. And the fuel from the forest refinery would not create fly ash by the million ton, and you wouldn't have to fill the 6-inch pipeline to the North Slope to sequester the carbon dioxide. Once again, if you have a plant that has carbon dioxide, you should sequester it with an algal plant because that's what that grows on. So Healy, any place, they should have its own little algal diesel plant alongside it. Okay, we should own our own little gas lines, just like having a road. It's transportation. It's less potholes fix. It's old technology. We get tariffs off the movement of our resources. So like Nenana to Fairbanks, Lubbock to Fairbanks, Fairbanks to Glen Allen, then to Cook Inlet, and a short spur line to Valdez to encourage a private liquefaction plant, and a GIA for all lines, including the transcontinental one to Alberta or to Valdez, or both, depending on the open season, that will ensure that the north...
Lisa, could I ask you to wrap up? We're now 5 minutes over our thing, and you're almost at 10 minutes. If you could just wrap up, we'd really appreciate that. Yeah, if you could just honestly go to that last page, and if you want to stick around and talk to your representatives, that would be great, or anyone else here, but we're supposed to be somewhere at 7.
Okay. Some important things to note is that the forest refinery is, cellulose loss of biomass is the only fuel that can replace petroleum in all aspects, including plastics, and that's, what the forest refinery is not going to make plastics, but they're going to make high-dollar chemicals and pharmaceuticals like xylitol and picogenol and the ethanol. But in other words, that is the wave of the future. That's where it's going. Dow Chemical is, by next year, going to have 25% of their plastics come from cellulosic biomass. So for us not to be in on it, Soldotna is interested in doing it because they have so much beetle kill that their forests are going to go up in smoke soon anyway. But you guys have $30 billion, and you've watched it whittle in 6 months' time. And to depend on, the equities market and all the corruption that has come out, it's like you need to rethink that. And you've got lots of good things going on here that should be paid attention to. One last teaser. I mean, everyone already knows the sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow, the current doesn't always, the tide isn't always in, and the currents, the river's not always high, but there is always a temperature differential between the inside and outside of any building, and except like maybe today you can throw the windows open, but you want cooling. But the thing is, what's coming is with some inverters and some nanotechnology insulation and they're going to be able to create electricity off of that thermal gradient differential, as opposed to having to go down 5,000 feet in the East Coast, 3,000 feet in the West Coast, or 12 feet down with a heat pump, which actually does work in this climate because there's quite a few people doing it right now. They will be able to make electricity just off of the inside and the outside of any building. And so, we need to be looking for that and not get too strung out in really expensive things that are old technology that aren't really efficient and you shouldn't take public money. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. We appreciate it, Lisa. Okay. With that, we're adjourned. Thank you to everyone for your patience and your ideas. And we look forward to talking with you again soon. Thank you.